House Committee on Business and Labor, and wish all of you a good morning. I hope you all had a good holiday. Thanksgiving's my favorite holiday. I turned 48 on Saturday. You wouldn't know it. Anyway, so today we're going to have an informational hearing on liquor agent compensation. We'll be doing the same on safety in the workplace. It's specifically having to do with impairment in the workplace, specifically those on prescription drugs of whatever kind or whatever kind of card they carry. We're going to start off with the liquor agent one, and then we'll go to the safety in the workplace issue. And then after we hear both of them, then this committee will decide which one of, or if any, of these two concepts will become a committee bill, and the deadline's on the 30th. And if I've made it clear that if the liquor agent bill is not the request of this committee, as our one committee bill that had been allotted to us through the rules for the February session, after this committee, if we still want to go forward with this, the advocates want to go forward with this, and the department and this committee, we will gladly make a request, a draft request for that. And the way that's working is all those requests are being sent to the Rules Committee, which then it's in their hands whether or not they make it a bill for February or not. There's still a chance that may be the committee bill, but there's a chance, a good chance, that it may not, and the other one may be. I just want to make that clear to everybody today, how we're going to do this. So we need to...
Okay.
I'm just going to open up an informational hearing on the Oregon Liquor Control Commission agent compensation. Would the liquor store agents line up, come up and give their arguments and information first, and then we'll go to the department? And if there's any questions come up, well, while the department's up here, you'll still be in the room, and I'd like to hear from all that. So... And this is a public hearing too. I have made it clear I did not want, you know, we're limited for time. So if there's something that anyone from the public absolutely has to get on the record, they're welcome to. I cannot and will not deny anyone that ability. But if we can keep this kind of short and tight today, because we are limited on time, I have to be somewhere else, so do all these other good people. If anything is not said and you feel compelled to come up and testify, you're welcome to. But if we can keep it tight and concise and get everything in right out of the gate, that'd be best. So go ahead, Mr. Kova, if you'd like to start off.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marshall Kova, representing Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon, and happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
I'm extremely thankful that we have this hearing, the opportunity to work with this committee to find a resolution to some of the issues facing liquor agents in Oregon. We look forward to working closely with you to finalize a legislative proposal for the February 2008 session. We believe the time is now to improve the retailing of distilled spirits in Oregon. We've lobbied it, we've studied it, we've task forced it, and now we need to act. To ensure the future of the system, as we know it today, will require some prudent investment. We come to you with ideas for improvements and changes with an eye to the future. Presenting those concepts will be John Feierstein, president of the association. As business people, we understand and appreciate that we'll need resources now, while times are good, to help us to be a relevant option for consumers when the market trends begin to flatten out. There's no question that sales statewide are good now. We continue to exceed projections as a sales force for the OLCC each biennium. But even in these robust times, many of the 243 agents across the state are struggling to stay ahead with the increases in rent and leases, payroll costs, insurances, utilities, OLCC mandates, and other costs of doing business. Now, with the help of this committee, we can look forward to implementing what I like to call, so far I'm the only one calling it this, the Liquor Agent Compensation Modernization and Fairness Act of 2008. Let me say that again. The Liquor Agent Compensation Modernization and Fairness Act of 2008. What's in the bill? Details are to follow, but I'm convinced that well-intentioned people from all facets of the industry can come up with a reasonable and fair plan in a short amount of time. Mr. Chair, we look forward to your leadership as we move forward. My role today is to give you some background and some perspective on how we've got to this point. I think it's important to understand that this discussion has gone on for a number of years, and a lot of this isn't new. I think the newest addition to the discussion is the agent compensation study, which was a budget note, came out of the 2005 Ways and Means Committee. We spent $434,000. It was late in that it was due last December, November, to be presented to the emergency board. And the intention, I think, coming out of 05 is that would be acted upon during the 07 session, whatever recommendations may or may not have come out of that. As it turns out, the contract wasn't signed until January 31 of this year, and this report is dated June 6, 2007. Of course, you remember we signed it died on about the 28th, so there was no action taken. What's happened since then is a task force was appointed by Chair Lang, the chairman of the OLCC, and we've met several times this fall, and I remain hopeful that something may come from that, but if not, I think this committee could be very helpful to us. The issue has gone on for years. Let me just take you back. I've got several different documents here. I'm going to read a sentence or a paragraph out of them. This is a fair compensation study, and yes, it's dated November 1998, almost 10 years ago, and it was information collected and submitted by a group of agents. But in here, they quote an OLCC staff composed white paper dated June 1998, so coming up on 9.5 years. In it, two items should be noted. One, agents and the commission are concerned that the cost of running a liquor store outstrips any gain seen from increased gross liquor sales over the years. And it has a couple examples here of increase in rental factors. And secondly, and this is an interesting one, and I think that really the crux of the issue here, without adequate funds, agents will move to less expensive and less customer-convenient locations. Reducing staff levels or staffing with less experienced people also reduces customer service. In the current employees market, agents cannot afford to successfully compete for competent employees. Inconvenient stores that are not well-maintained produce discontent and ultimately skepticism about the entire control state system. Again, that's 10 years ago, and I think you could hear of the 243 agents across the state, a good percentage of them would continue along that same line of discussion. What I handed out to you today is that testimony that we presented to the Ways and Means Committee. I think it was February 6th, 2007. I don't hand it out because it was that extraordinary, but I think the tone of it is, I think the tone and the tenor of the discussion is fairness. We continue to put hundreds and hundreds of man hours into this process, and we're waiting for the study. We're hopeful that the study will come out. We're hopeful that the study suggestions will be implemented, and we're hopeful that the study will be a quality study. And it's a consistent and clear message that we need more funds to meet the expectations of the OLCC and the public. This is another document, a retail business plan for the year 2000 and beyond. Retail business plan for the year 2000 and beyond, put out by the OLCC, and it's talking about modernizing the system, where we need to go, what needs to happen as we move forward in retailing liquor. There's a one page here I'm going to read very briefly, but to accomplish the Commission's retail mission to provide quality customer service in making packaged distilled spirits available to legal users, the OLCC has adopted these overall aims to assure our retail system goes beyond surviving and on to thriving. And I will tell you that everything in this book is supported by the agents. Bigger stores, better locations, better parking, more friendly, especially to a lot of the female consumers, and nothing in here that we don't support. The bottom line to it is to move from where some of the locations where the liquor stores are located currently to the place across town or across the street that might be more desirable. The rent factor goes up significantly, and I think that there's an A, B, and a C here. To manage the retail operations using good business principles, including facilitating agents applying their entrepreneurial skills to run the stores as a business. I think there'll be some disagreement from agents about how much entrepreneurial opportunities there are. B, to optimally meet stakeholders' needs to keep Oregon's liquor control system relevant in today's business and political environment. I think there are various stakeholders, some of them more happy. I think the Restaurant Association would be happy with that comment. I think distilled folks would be happy with that comment. Again, I think the agents are the ones left behind. And C, to continuously improve the operation and system, including exploring opportunities to modernize and enhance the business through legislative means. And to modernize and enhance the business through legislative means. And to the extent that that is modernizing and enhancing the liquor agent side of it, the liquor stores, 243 stores across the state. I've been working with the agents for the last three sessions. I'm almost at a loss to come up with any legislative proposal that was brought down. And there's been some discussion, but nothing significant that I can remember. And I think that's the key of why we're here today. I think there's been some discussion, again, going back to the year 2000, the millennium, to modernize these stores, and we're still waiting. The retailing goals, if I can hit on those, there's six of them, one sentence. One, improve shopping opportunities. We're all for it. Two, provide attractive and friendly shopping environments. All for it. Three, improve customer service. We're all for it. Four, and this one has a real conflict inherent in it, maintain high profitability to benefit state and local governments. And I think one of the easiest ways to maintain profitability for the OLCC is the one cost that they can really control is agent compensation. And so as you look at that, goal four, maintain high profitability to benefit state and local governments, and I'll talk a little bit more about the money in a minute. Five, establish and maintain a performance-based compensation system for agents. We're heading into year eight of 2000s, still not finalized. And six, excel in liquor law compliance. Again, all for it. So, another document, more history, the discussion goes on. Beyond that, I guess back to when you're talking about the legislative means to enhance and modernize the system, if you remember going back three or four years ago, there was a store-in-a-store pilot program concept where some liquor stores were being opened in grocery stores. I think there was a plan to open six of those, I believe four, and I could be off one on each of those. But that was seen, I think, initially some of the early discussion as an opportunity for some high-performing agents maybe to have a second store. That's not the way it came down at all. As a matter of fact, this was done not necessarily with agents, but more to agents. And to the extent that was a legislative proposal, again, finds us on opposite sides. Three.
Marshall, please, what specifically would you describe what happened there when you say two agents on the store in the grocery store concept?
Store in a store, there's a long story there, but the store in a store idea was a concept developed by the OLCC to add more stores in some high growth areas. And I'm not certain where they all are. I think there's one in Eugene, there's one in a Portland high growth area. But historically, the addition of new stores, as I understand it, John might be able to answer this better, there's been some discussion. I mean, there's some territorial respect, and you don't put a new store right next to an existing store, for instance. One of these new stores was put relatively close to an existing store. So while we can say that it was a success, it sold $1 million plus its first or second year, the $1 million came from somewhere, and some of it may have been new business, but at the same time, it was business taken from an existing agent. So just another example. In February 2003, the Mayor Drake, we call this the Mayor Drake study, from the city of Beaverton, provided to the legislators, he says here, it is with pride that I convey to you the final report of the Oregon Alcohol Beverage Industry Task Force. The task force was appointed by Governor John Kitzhaber in mid-2002 to examine contemporary issues related to the OLCC and the alcohol beverage industry. I can just point you quickly to... It came up with some recommendations. One, allow liquor agents more flexibility in advertising the stores and their products. A nice idea, but not a major issue for us. But secondly, increase the agent compensation fund, regularly calculated at 8.54% of forecasted liquor sales. So, again, this was a group of a lot of different folks, including agents, but actually a lot of them are not agents. And the sentence here is, for many agents, their current level of compensation does not adequately fund their making store improvements, moving to more customer-accessible locations, modernizing inventory and financial equipment with computers, or paying their family-level wages high enough to afford health insurance premiums. I give you the literature review, I think, because it's interesting. I think there's some of this going back 10 years, I think, is the oldest document I had. We can go back, and there's a whole stack. I've got a lot of a paper, and I'm not going to bore you with it, but I think the recent trend is there's no question that in 2003 we got a slight increase, 34 basis points, which was $1.9 million total spread throughout the system, and is an increase in agent compensation. In 2005, instead of potentially another slight increase, we you got the study, and now here it is coming up on January 108, and we're still looking for some implementation. So I think that, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. There seems to be a lot of discussion about this. We spent $434,000 on a study. There's a lot of smoke, so there must be an issue here, is what I would like to believe. We believe there are more sales to be had, more revenue to be generated for the state and local governments. As I mentioned, there's a task force now. The task force has had several meetings, and we're scheduled to meet again next week and then make some sort of a proposal to the commission, I believe, at the December meeting. You know, there's no question that we look forward to a productive outcome of the study, and we believe that there's been some real disconnect between the agents and the commission over the years, and as to what are appropriate ways to enhance, modernize, and add fairness to the retailing of liquor in Oregon. You know, our goal is to improve the retailing of distilled spirits in Oregon, and I think as you look to the future, there's a lot of money being generated through the system. You know, but different groups have different goals. Some want more sales and more volume. Some folks involved in this want less volume and less drinking. Some want more sales with more revenue for state and local governments. And I point to you, I went to the OLCC website last night and printed this out, and as you start talking about the liquor stores and you start talking about revenue, just to give everybody perspective about what we're talking about here, this was fiscal year 2006-2007, revenue side, total of $395 million went in the door at the OLCC. $375 million, this is 1 year, $375 million was from distilled spirits. License and fees, $4 million, that'd probably be your restaurant tours, and the taxes on beer and wine at $15.2 million. So to compare hard liquor, $375, beer and wine, $15.2. So there is, I think, an incentive, a fiduciary responsibility from the legislative body to understand and appreciate that we're creating a lot of revenue. Total distribution in that year was $141 million, or at that rate, $280 million for the biennium to state and local governments. So some serious, serious cash. And all we're asking for is some sort of a fairness and modernization. And it includes a number of different things, and John can talk about that. And so in conclusion, I think the system, the future of the system needs investment. And I think there's some risk. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure there's some risk if there is not some investment relatively soon. There's lots of revenue at stake. And in conclusion, we look forward to working with this committee to find a solution to present to the 08 session. Thank you. And with me is John Feierstein. He's the president of the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, committee members. My name is John Feierstein, agent at Eastport Liquor in Portland and president of the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon. I have been in the retail business for 30-plus years, 10 years working for a major retailer, 15 years owning and operating a chain of gift and home decor stores, and the last 10 years as a liquor agent. I worked under and administered various pay and incentive programs. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this important issue for the 243 agents, their families and employees, and their families. The discussion is also important to many state and local government programs that rely on the tax revenue from the sales that come from our stores. That is why, now while sales are good, is the time to fix our compensation system to allow a bright and successful future for liquor retailing in Oregon and continue to support the important government programs with these funds. Our concern is that without a fix our system, the huge amounts of tax revenue it creates will be at risk. A prudent investment now is an insurance policy to ensure a healthy and vibrant retail environment tomorrow. I have personally been involved in the agent compensation study from day one and member of the task force review of the study the last several months. Agents have spent thousands of man hours to get to the point we're at today. Delays in study completion, task force review, meeting after meeting have resulted in no incentive for 2006, no incentive for 2007, and continued profit erosion in the problem areas, Portland Metro and the Oregon coast, as defined by the study. After exhaustive review, the time to act is now. The task force has endorsed supporting non-limited funding and an incentive plan. Movement has been glacial. Finally, we do have an incentive proposal we feel can work. Agent requests have been greatly tempered through this process in order to find some common ground. Initially, agents wanted an across-the-board increase to base compensation. We quickly realized this was not sufficient due to the fact an incentive was crucial for our success. We agreed totally. Realize we work under an incentive plan currently in that we are paid on a percent of sales. The 8.88 we work under currently is not enough to allow for proper remuneration of our people, store expansion, computer upgrades, and ever-increasing store expenses. The study clarifies problem areas in Oregon and clearly states the profit erosion taking place in those areas. The study worked with tax returns from agents covering the years 2000 to 2005. It is the agent's contention that this profit erosion has spread to many other parts of the state. Sales have been very good, but not enough to offset salary cost pressures and rent factors, our two biggest expenditures. Consequently, we feel a proposed incentive plan is something we can work with. We also need an increase in our base of 1 to 1.5%. Why both an incentive and an increase to base? I'll use my store as an example. In the last year and a half, we reinvested approximately $30,000 to better reward my people, make improvements to store interior and computer systems. I like to think because of those improvements, business has been very good. The hard work and money that went into that did earn our store an outstanding rating for 2007. In no way did the increase in sales dollars pay for those improvements. An increase of over $200,000 in sales resulted in an additional $15,000 in compensation and an investment of over $30,000. It did add approximately $80,000 net profit to the state. The addition of the proposed incentive plan would have helped greatly, but any slowdown in sales over the previous year would greatly diminish the incentive payout and revert to the 8.88, which caused profit erosions in the previous years. Agents have done what was asked in supplying vital personal information and getting the study completed. We have suffered through delays of coming up with an answer for improved compensation. The time to act is now. Agents want to look forward to improving their people's lives and store appearances while responsibly running our liquor stores and the profit we return to the state. Thank you for your time and attention to this issue. We are confident the right people in a room could come up with a fair and rational fix to the compensation issue. We look forward to working with this committee to implement a fix to the issue. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, gentlemen. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Cameron?
Thank you. Mr. Firestein. Thank you for your testimony today. Just a question on your, towards the end of your testimony, you were talking about some numbers there. In the last year and a half, we invested $30,000 to people and some store improvements and computer system. Can you break down that $30,000 investment, how much of that was actually in people versus capital improvements in your store?
Probably a third people, two-thirds leasehold improvements, computers.
So 10,000 in people?
Maybe a little bit more, but in that range, yes.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to bring up a point that if you end up with a $15,000 gain in some of those improvements, you're going to amortize over a few years, correct?
A few years, yes. A few years.
Okay. Thank you.
I apologize to you gentlemen for having to step out. Any further questions?
Yes, sir.
Representative Furley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, this is kind of new to me, first of all, being new on this committee and not really having looked into this. It would be helpful, I think, if I understood a little bit more how this whole compensation thing is structured. Our committee administrator gave us a little background paper here the other week, and I've got a few questions based on that, if I could just go ahead and ask them, Mr. Chair. It talks about retail liquor stores and then non-exclusive stores. Now, if I understand correctly, the non-exclusive store would be, for example, the one that's in the grocery store.
Or a store, for instance, in Joseph, Oregon, that has the hardware and gift store in a section of liquor.
Okay. Then in this paper, it talks about, thank you, Since all agents are paid monthly and receive base compensation plus approximately 7.15% of monthly consumer sales and 5.58% of monthly dispenser sales, could you explain to me a little bit more what that is? Because one of the things that I'm missing here is if we're talking about 7.15% of monthly consumer sales and 5.58% of dispenser sales, what's the 8.8% that I see tossed around?
The 8.88 is the maximum that can be paid out for agent compensation. So in order to sell liquor in Joseph, Oregon, they need to be compensated a little bit more to sell liquor since they're not selling the volumes that we are. So consequently, a non-exclusive store may be paid, I don't know, you'd have to ask the payroll guys, say 15 to 18%. I don't make 8.88% by a long shot. I make about 7.4, 7.3%. On my base rate. So all I'm saying is overall the average comes out to 8.88% maximum.
Representative Bird, I think an interesting, a simple way to look at it is the more you sell, the lower your percentage.
So the percentage, also in this briefing paper that the committee administrator gave us, it says the percentages are adjusted every 6 months. Who does that? Who makes those adjustments?
Michael O'Connor with his crystal ball.
I don't know who Michael O'Connor is.
He's the payroll guy for OLCC. Right, Michael?
Okay.
He's here. But what they have to do is, lately, business has been good, so they're paying out at 8%. If they can see that they're paying out at too much of a rate, they have to back that off in order to hit at year end the 8.88. And that's where the overage is for the non-limited, that then they go to the e-board to ask for the additional money of the sales that we did have that would, in effect, go over the 8.88%. Go over the total dollar amount that's been stipulated at the start of the biennium of 8.88.
Representative Berta, can I give you a liberal arts interpretation on that one? The OLCC budget has a line item in it of agent compensation. We will be paid X. We call it $10 million. If sales go through the roof, that's what the budgeted amount is. So as you approach that $10 million, they lower the rates so they don't go over it. I mean, that's their responsibility as an agency to manage the money. We then need to go back to the e-board, and historically have done that each biennium, and they have to make a decision, affirmative decision, to pay us for the additional sales. And that's one of the issues that we've talked about, and that's one of the issues that is in the study and was in a couple of these documents I've talked about. It's called the non-limited issue, which is just to not make it a line item of X, say $10 million, but just pay us on sales. I believe that's what they do with the lottery. You sell a lottery ticket, you get paid for the sale of a lottery ticket. You sell liquor, up to a point you get paid. And two times in history, one of those being during the many special sessions back in the early 2000s, we didn't get paid to the tune of $800,000. I think that's fair. It might not be that high, but several hundred thousand dollars anyway that agents didn't get paid for sales made at the time. So e-board has discretion to do that. We would like to get paid, and there's an issue there of cash flow. There's an issue there of fairness that we would like to move that from a limited line item to a non-limited line item.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Burley.
The 8.88%, is that fixed in law?
Fixed by the legislator.
Is that in statute? I see a head in the back of the room going no. So maybe I'll defer that. I presume the department's going to come up and testify, so I'll defer that question. So if I may, Mr. Chair, I want to kind of summarize what I just heard here. Well, I've got another question first. Mr. Firestein, as an agent, you have a contract with the state, I presume?
Yes, Representative.
Is that renewed annually?
Every 5, or if you achieve an outstanding rating, you can qualify for a 10-year contract.
Okay. What does your contract say you're going to get as far as this 8.88%? Is that in there at all? What does the contract state?
I think it states we get paid at the percent arrived at by the legislature.
So the legislature sets that percentage every biennium?
Well, they could, but in my 10 years, it's been adjusted up slightly one time. So it's not adjusted every biennium, no, not by any means.
Okay.
It's a little confused. Believe me, I worked under the system for 3 years before I kind of figured it out, the pay system.
Well, I must say, I certainly understand this issue about the limited versus non-limited expenditure, and I'll probably defer this question for the department as well, because I actually sent Mr. Lang an email asking this question and haven't gotten a response yet, but I'm curious what the history is behind that, because I understand that sometimes it's been limited and sometimes it has not been limited. But it seems to me if the agent's compensation is being cut because we're running up against this limited cap, that seems rather counterproductive to me.
It's still paid out overall at the 8.88. The overall compensation is paid out at 8.88.
To you individually? You get your 8.88 all the time?
No. Because the overall percent is 8.88, where the smaller stores make, and they should, make a higher percent selling the same thing we make to have liquor available throughout other parts of the state. Consequently, the larger stores have to make a smaller percent to leverage doing business in other parts of the state.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, again, forgive me for kind of monopolizing but let's put the percentage aside for a moment.
Okay.
Explain to me what this base compensation is. You don't have the benefit of this briefing paper, but it shows six different classes: annual sales, base compensation for class one up to $210,000 annual sales is 13% of the first 10,000 monthly sales, and then there's dollar figures as those annual sales go up. What exactly is that?
I'm a class six store, which is the highest level in Oregon, sales volume-wise. I get paid base of $2,600 a month, and then the percentages start kicking in after that of over-the-counter sales and dispenser sales, which are even less than dispensers.
Explain dispenser. What's a dispenser?
A dispenser is a restaurant, Class A liquor license holder. So Marshall's got exactly right. The more large stores sell, the lower your percent. Because you're, what's the base consumer? 7.1%,
7.75?
7.15, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I got my $2,600 and 7.15 on consumer, and less than that for dispenser. And then those all add up to your compensation check. And from that, every single thing is paid, the store operation.
So the more sales you do, the lower your percent may be.
Right.
But the higher your base is.
No, the base stays the same. The $2,600 stays the same.
Well, relative to a smaller store, your base is higher. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. This is complex. Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think it is important that we understand that the full compensation. And so on a monthly basis, you're receiving $2,600 as a base. And then the base compensation is approximately 7.15% of the monthly consumer sales.
Right.
So if you have $100,000 in consumer sale, or in your case it's more than that, it sounds like, but $200,000, so you're compensated another $1,400 and some odd for that 7.5% on consumer sales.
Right.
The restaurant guy walks in the door and buys a whole bunch of stuff, and you're compensated 5.58%
right.
for that. Okay, so you add all that up, and that's your monthly compensation.
Right.
Interesting to see a monthly profit and loss statement. So on top of that, how do we get to this? Okay, so the 7.1, is that the... That's for your level of store. How does, if we take, let's say, the store in John Day, I use Detroit Lake because I go up there and there's a little grocery store with a liquor deal. Mm-hmm. Don't buy it, but I notice they have a little, that's the non-exclusive stores we're talking about. So how does that vary or different? And I guess I'm trying to, this doesn't add up to the 8.8% or the 15% that we were talking about that we're hearing. So that guy up there, on a monthly basis, is being compensated, it looks like, according to this deal, 13% of the first $10,000. Is that correct?
Right.
In Detroit? That's his base?
Well, then he starts out with the base also, and then his percents kick in. I haven't worked under the non-exclusive pay program, so I'm not completely up to speed on that. But what I can tell you is the smaller, from what I understand, a store exactly like you're talking about makes between 15 and 18% on a sale, which they should.
Including their base.
Including their base, right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, so how we get to your 8.8, or potentially you could be, is if you add your base in to the compensation of the 7.15%, if your base and your 7.15% goes over the 8.8%, that's when I would cut back on the 7.15%, so that your base, so your total compensation doesn't go over the 8.5%?
Overall, yes.
Okay.
Overall.
Overall, Representative Cameron, overall meaning statewide. At the beginning of a biennium, everybody gets paid as we go.
Okay, now here's where I'm losing it. Because we're talking about as I grow sales, I get paid a less percentage. So my sales go from $200,000 a month to $300,000 a month. I'm not compensated the 7.15% on the additional $100,000?
Yes, but my $2,600 doesn't get any bigger. So as you sell more, it more approaches the 7.1%.
Okay, so now I'm understanding this. So you're paid 7.15% on every dollar of
consumer
alcohol in your store.
Right.
So we don't go down on the percentage of dollars. It's just what we're doing here is because I have some fixed payments as a percentage of my total sales, that percentage goes down.
Right, right, right.
Got it.
Any further questions of these gentlemen?
Well, maybe we'll see this, Mr. Sheriff, if I may. I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
Maybe we'll see this, but I guess it would be really interesting to see and maybe go visit a couple stores. In my case, I wouldn't mind coming out and visiting a retailer here locally and actually looking at how they run their business compared to other small businesses. And I understand that it's this contract with the state, but there's some fixed payments as well as some percentages. And to see, I know in other businesses in the state we're struggling with sales increases and our percentages compensation is different, but it'd be real interesting to see the model, because it's one thing to sit here and talk about, and there's a study out there, and obviously you could look at one business, but it doesn't talk about the industry as a whole. There's a study out there. It's interesting to see the real numbers and how they compensate out.
Hey, I think it'd be good for all of us to, and all legislators, to go visit a store or two in their districts. The good committee administrator and I also toured the OLCC warehouse in Milwaukee last week, and I would recommend everybody doing that as well. Any further questions, these gentlemen? All right. After today's hearing, some of the phone conversations I've recently had, I may be visiting one of your stores this afternoon. Anyway. Okay.
And would you gentlemen have anything more to say?
Mr. Chair, just one last comment, and I think Representative Burley, you hit on it. A lot of this stuff is new to you. This discussion, at least in my time here, I think going back to 03, has been exclusively in the Ways and Means Committee. And I really appreciate the opportunity to come talk to a policy committee about some of this stuff, because it's the discussion has been in the Ways and Means Committee.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, very good.
We'd like to have any and all of you come to the store. Thank you.
If nothing else, thank you. I'm going to call up the department and all of his staffers or anybody you want to bring with. I trust we all had a good holiday.
Yes.
Thanks.
Whenever you're ready, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Steve Fowler, Executive Director of the OLCC, and very happy to be here today. Before I get started into my short presentation, do you want to start off with any questions to try and resolve or deal with?
Anybody want to follow up on any questions you had of the agents and their representatives?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I'd rather wait and hear what they have to say. That may answer some of the questions or trigger new ones. Thank you.
Go ahead, guys. We'll jump in when we need to.
In 2005, the Oregon legislature directed the OLCC to undertake a review of the current agent compensation schedule and to make recommendations for updating the payment schedule. It was to do so in order to allow for facility upgrades and assure the agent's compensation is sufficient to provide, along with income from other products sold in the liquor store, the cost of doing business. The study was completed and presented to the OLCC in June 2007. The commission accepted the study, which was conducted by a local consultant firm. The study included 9 recommendations. The commission then created the agent's task force in July of 2007 to consider the recommendations, and its report is due back this December. Merle Lindsay, director of the Distilled Spirits Program, will now comment on the task force.
Thank you, Mr. Earl. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Merle Lindsay. I'm the Distilled Spirits Program Director. I'm happy to give you an update this morning on where our task force is. You heard earlier from Mr. Koba that Chairman Lang put together a task force after listening to the agent's concerns regarding the DHK study and appointed me chair of that task force. And we are to report back to the commissioners at their December commission meeting with any sort of consensus-based recommendations that we can all collectively agree upon. You heard earlier that the DHK study included 9 recommendations. Our task force took those recommendations and split them into 2 categories. The first group being those recommendations that the OLCC has authority to implement. And then the second two being those things that would require legislative action. You heard the focus of our task force, we have met 5 times. We have 1 more scheduled meeting for 6th time. I'm not sure that we'll be able to get all of our work done in that one meeting, so we may have additional before we report back to the commissioners at the December meeting. The focus of that task force are those things that require legislative action. You've heard earlier about attacking the issue of moving the agent's compensation fund from a limited to a non-limited to address those issues of making sure that the agents are given what they've guaranteed, what the legislature guarantees with them. This is the 8.88%. The second thing that we have looked at and are very interested in, and we have a subcommittee working on, is an incentive-based program. You've heard about the issues of making store improvements, retaining good employees, moving to better locations, and we're hopeful that that incentive plan will address that particular issue. And then also, thirdly, we're looking at something that will help the problem areas that have been identified in the study, and those being in the Portland metro and coast areas. And we're looking, hopefully, that will bring forward something that we can look at to help those agents. That's basically where we are at this point. I'd be happy to answer any questions with regards to the task force.
Thank you. Do you guys have anything further to add?
Consider to answer questions if we have.
Okay, very good. Sure. Thanks for the tour the other day. That was very helpful, and I hope we can help you in getting some money for you to, get that product out the door faster. I think from what I saw, you certainly have a good argument. And I also want to thank you for the good job you all with the liquor agents do in providing a product here safely in this state and also for all the revenue we generate from your department and those liquor agents over here to help us fund all the educate and medicate and incarcerate here in the state of Oregon. It really is a great process, and at the same time, we do it safely and keep alcohol out of the hands of kids. Any questions of these gentlemen? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment, then a question. First, the comment. I like these type of graphs. Everybody in the audience, take note, please, in the future when we're talking about numbers. Graphs help a lot. Secondly, it's been brought up now both sets of testimony about problem areas, Portland Metro and Oregon Coast. Could you expand a little bit on what problem areas mean? Are those the areas that are specifically having problems with the store compensation model, or are we talking about other types of problems?
I'll make a couple of comments on that with regards to the coast and the Portland metro areas. What the study found was that there were profit erosion in those two particular areas. And I think basically a part of the conclusion that they came to was that they're in with respect to Portland metro area, you are work in mature neighborhoods where there's no additional population growth, which in fact will drive the additional sales and bring you in more compensation. Also, probably in both areas, they're in fairly high cost areas for them to make their lease payments and things of that nature, and then they're competing for employees with other employers, and again they're seeing eroding profits in those areas. With respect to the coast, they don't see the holiday peaks and valleys the same that we experience here in the Portland metro area. It's when the tourists go away, therefore your sales will go away as well. So they don't have the opportunity to have those build up for the holidays.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, with regards to the coast, perhaps a normal business model at the coast, when the tourists are there at the high season, prices might adjust up a little bit to take advantage of the volume of customers that are there, and when things soften, then they lower their prices because there's not as much people around. Of course, our agents do not have that liberty. We set the price, and that price stays consistent unless there's normal price adjustments in there.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I ask my questions, would you, if you identified yourself, I apologize for missing. Would you please?
My name is Michael O'Connor. I'm the Director of Financial Services for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm the one who administers the agent compensation payments each month.
Okay, great. So you're the one in the hot seat then.
That's it.
The one with the crystal ball.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me, I sent an email to your chair, Mr. Lang, with a few questions, and being over the holidays, I'm sure he didn't have a chance to get back to me. So let me ask you these questions. And the 8.88%, is that set by the legislature?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Burley, that is a budgetary note in the legislatively approved budget that sets both the limitation, the fixed amount of dollars, and the expected average payout rate. I might explain that the 8.88 is not an amount that any single agent gets specifically. That's merely an amount that the legislature has determined that average over the entire system is to be paid out over the two-year period. We use the formula then to allocate the fixed amount of dollars that were given to us to ensure that we're not exceeding that average of 8.88 for everybody across the system.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. So when an agent signs that five-year contract with the state, he or she has no idea what percent they're going to get on sales over that five-year contract. Is that an accurate statement?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Burley, that's correct. It's established each two-year period by the legislature, the amount of agents' compensation fund to be paid out, and the average rate for the entire system to be paid out.
Wow, that's interesting.
Follow up.
Thank you. So would you then please address the question I asked earlier? Give us a little bit of the history on this limited versus non-limited expenditure. Has it gone from one to the other over time, and why, and What's the current status?
Vice Chair Holvey, Representative Burley. As I understand it, it has always been a limited amount. I've been with the Commission for 13 years, and during that period of time, it has always been an amount established by the legislature, a limited amount.
Follow up?
Mr. Chair?
Keep following you.
Thank you. Also, in Mr. Lang's email to us, he'd mentioned the credit debit card fee issue. Is that relevant? Is that the same? Is that all mixed up in this same package?
Vice Chair Holvey, Representative Burley. It is somewhat in the fact that let me first go back to the limited, non-limited. Essentially, some of the issues that have swirled around the limited, non-limited is that based upon our projection of sales, and you have those charts, those good graphs, as Representative Edwards pointed out, shows that whatever we forecasted, whatever we agreed upon, we were going to set the number for the forecast, then the budgetary amount for the agent's compensation fund is then set. The dilemma has been in the past, when we do better than what our forecast is, obviously the compensation amount that is to go to the agents needs to increase because we're producing more revenue. It makes sense. The dilemma comes is that as we get to that point when we recognize that we need additional funds, we then have to go back to the e-board to ask for the additional funds. So during that time frame, once again, now we're not sure if the e-board is going to approve those additional funds, so we have to pull back the rate that we're paying out somewhat till we're sure we get the money. So, and I can paint a sort of a picture here. We're certainly, and I am passionate about this. If an agent does a lot of the right things and brings a lot of people in and fixes the store up for the season and does really well, sales really take off across the state, and they do all this investment, and we're exceeding the rate that we're going to get, be able to pay them at, unless we go to the e-board, we then have to pull that rate down somewhat till we're sure we get the money from the e-board. Well, if you as a small contractor spend the money doing the right things, making the sales, you would expect if you invest X, you're going to get Y based upon your percentage of sales. But that doesn't always happen because we're not sure we're going to go ahead and get the money from the e-board. So I wanted to clarify that on the limited, non-limited.
Well, and I understand that. And unfortunately, nobody from LFO is here that I'm aware of or could enlighten me and perhaps a whole panel on why we do that way. But you mentioned this agent's compensation fund, which I'm guessing is a percent of the sales that goes into this fund to pay the agents their base, their commission, their credit, debit fee, all that kind of stuff goes into that fund. If I buy a bottle of liquor at the retail store, I spend $30 on a bottle of liquor. Is there a fixed percent of that retail price that goes to the state and the remainder goes to the agent compensation fund?
No, please.
Vice Chair Holvey, Representative Burley, not per se in a bottle. We don't necessarily do the calculation per bottle. It just based upon the amount of revenue that we get in, that's where the breakout starts. We have to go ahead and pay for the liquor itself, and then we go ahead and break out whatever the sales are for the that particular store, and then go ahead and break out at the rate they're paid, their base, and their rate that they're going to get paid based upon consumer sales and licensee sales. And before I forget, your question, I apologize, your question also asked a question about debit and credit cards. I need to go back to that. It is somewhat the same as the limited, non-limited. We get, based upon a projection, a certain amount of money in the budget that covers credit card fees. And that's based upon whatever percentage we think the credit card use is going to be. If the credit card use accelerates beyond that, we end up in the same situation as we do with the limited, non-limited in terms of agents comp. We then have to go back and say, well, a lot of consumers are coming in. They're buying up, which is what's happening in the marketplace. And, of course, if you're going to buy a $200 bottle of scotch, most people are not walking around $200 in cash, so they're going to use their credit card. That drives up the credit card fees, and therefore then we have to go ahead and go back to the e-board to ask for additional monies for that.
Does the state pay or does the agent pay the credit debit fee?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Burley, the state pays the credit card fees. And if I could clarify as well, too, it's actually two different funds. Agent's compensation is a separate fund. The credit and debit card fees are in the administrative fund.
One last question.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Lindsay, in your testimony, you talked about the remaining two recommendations classified as requiring legislative action. One of them deals with this non-limited budget item, which I think is becoming increasingly clear. But the other is that any other recommendation that would expand the budgeted agent compensation amount. I'm still having problems figuring out how that is, because if you take the lottery system, if I'm not mistaken, the lottery commission sets all of that, don't they? Now, there's been attempts to get the legislature to wade in on that thing, but it hasn't. So I'm trying to understand who sets the agent compensation amount. Does the legislature set that in Ways and Means, or does OLCC set that?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Burley, the legislature sets the percentage. And the percentage is just, it's based on the revenue forecast that we have, and whatever percentage that the legislature decides upon, in this case it being the 8.88%, we multiply 8.88% times the sales dollars, and that sets that fixed fund.
Okay. All right. That's clear. Thanks.
If I may,
yes, please.
Lots of questions. This is so upside down. I don't know how you run a business doing. So, just so I'm clear here, and I'm starting to understand this a little bit more, the 7.15 we were focused on a little bit earlier to the high volume store, when the guy in John Day who were paying maybe 15% has a great month, and you combine all those guys that are having great months. So now I'm understanding that John would not get his 7.15% because we're going to go over the overall payout of 8.8%, so John's commission gets cut back at some point in time on his 7.1%.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Cameron, if I may, just to clarify, the 8.88% really has no bearing on the amount that we pay any individual agent. That's strictly the legislative amount that the legislator has established, saying, here's the average that you're to pay over the entire system. To accomplish the payout, we have the formula that the commission administers, and that has a base comp percentage, a fixed base comp amount, and the percentages that we're talking about. If during the period of time during the biennia our sales exceed what we had forecast, but we still have the same fixed amount of dollars, if you divide the fixed amount of dollars by the now higher sales amount, you have a higher percentage than was originally intended. So the 8.88% is nothing more than how the pool of dollars is established. On a monthly basis, when we pay out the compensation, fixed compensation comes first. That's the base comp. In Mr. Firestein's example, $2,600 a month, he's going to get that regardless of the amount of sales. Then the percentages that we're paying is just that. It's a variable rate based on what his sales volume was for that particular month. If for the two-year period, so I establish it, and I'm sorry, the figures you have right now are old figures. They're actually at 7.75% right now for consumer sales. Projecting out over a two-year period, if our sales are going to go up, I can't exceed that fixed pool of money. So I back off on the variable rate slightly to make sure that at the end of the time, if the e-board does not give us more funds, that we're not going to exceed the average rate. But on a month-to-month basis, every agent gets their fixed comp, and they get a variable compensation based on their actual sales dollars. In no case do we back off on somebody's compensation amount.
Go ahead. Follow up, if I may. So unlike the lottery, and I'm not sure, I'm not real familiar with the lottery, but I think this is the way it happens. If I have X amount of dollar sales as a lottery retailer, it's already in contract through lottery that I'm going to get paid this percentage regardless. If I double my sales, if the lottery triples its sales, I mean, we're going to have $1 billion in lottery revenue. So if the lottery triples its sales, I don't have to worry as a lottery retailer that I'm that compensation is going to flow through to me. Is that correct? Right? I think it is. But the way we operate the OLCC, the way we operate the OLCC today, as an OLCC operator, I have to worry about that commission flowing through if I triple my sales because of the overall. Well, let's fix that. I mean, how hard is this to fix? That's the big thing right there.
Representative, I share your frustration, and to be quite frank with you, it creates a disincentive to sell more product responsibly here in the state of Oregon. And these guys right here are just carrying out the mission that this legislature has directed them to do. So they're stuck in the middle of this, and these folks over here are, in my opinion, from what I've learned of this very complex issue, are disincentivized to providing and selling and promoting more sale of the product, which in the end everybody loses, in my humble opinion.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
please go ahead.
Well, to me it didn't sound like it. Eventually, if you come back to e-board, we get the money and we can, if the e-board, if we're having a great year as the board of directors sitting up here, we say, yeah, you can have the money and pay these guys that earned it. Right? I mean, they end up getting it, but it's never a guaranteed deal for doing my business. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, actually in two instances, the e-board did not go ahead and grant the additional money. So, in fact, the agents would have been shorted a percentage of dollars.
And you know what? That's just flat out wrong. That's like telling a laborer on Friday, you're going to pay him for 30 hours when he worked 40. And right. I tell you, that don't go over very well with me. So we do, unless there's some real pressing questions, I want to kind of move on. Representative Hurley, did you have any questions here? I don't want to leave any.
Well, just real briefly, do you think this task force is going to come up with a model that will pay liquor agents fairly? Because it appears to me the model we have now doesn't allow for proper growth or for them to meet their expanding expenses when their sales exceed our projections.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, we really do need to wait till the commissioners have weighed in on the recommendations from the committee to really answer for the commission, except on one thing. That's the limited, non-limited. The commission has gone on the record for several years now saying that we would prefer to be at non-limited so that the commission does not have to worry whether, if sales are doing great guns, whether we're going to have the money to go ahead and pay the agents. So that I can tell you after talking with Chairman Lang and knowing that that's what we put forth in previous legislative sessions, that portion there will certainly, we will want to do that and endorse that for the task force.
I couldn't agree more. We need to take the legislative involvement out of the payment of this money, is to come back and ask for money that's owed you, the e-board, when there's other interests that have their eye on that money, is just flat out wrong. So, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. It seems to me that if we were to make the aging compensation fund a non-limited expenditure, we should also at the same time either direct OLCC, because I'd rather that the legislature not necessarily set commission rates, but somehow there needs to be a fixed commission rate so that the agents know what they're going to get for every dollar they sell. I mean, it just, to me, it defies logic that if you're in sales, and I don't care if you're selling widgets or alcohol, you get a certain percent of your sales. And it doesn't matter if you sell one unit or 1,000 units, you get the same percent of sales. And it seems to me that that's what the agents ought to be getting. So, I'd still like to hear the rationale on why these, when in fact, if Ways and Means or the e-board twice did not grant the higher exemption.
But I'd like to hear it too, but we're not going to hear it today.
We don't have time today. So, anyways, thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, for indulging my last minute question. And I have had this question answered already, but I forgot what the answer was. Do agents have exclusive territories, or is there competition within
a given geography for store locations.
Okay, whether you want me to.
Because I think it's relevant when we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, there is no exclusive territory. For instance, if you want to go ahead and buy a bottle from a liquor store, you can go to any liquor store at any time and choose to do that. If you are a restaurateur, you also have that same privilege. There is no exclusive areas.
Follow up.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
So does the state or does the commission regulate who can own stores within a given geography? I mean, I know there may not be an exclusive on who you can sell to or who can buy from you, but I guess I'm wondering, we have my local shopping center, the anchor store's a Fred Meyer, and then there's a liquor store, and it's the only liquor store that I'm aware of in my general area where I live. Could another agent come in and go in the shopping center across the street? There's a space for lease open. Can they set up shop there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, no. During the process, the Retail Services Division reviews where the store locations are, and we try to keep a certain distance between the stores so that there is a reasonable opportunity for the agent that's in that store to have a certain territory. For instance, as a convenience for you, we want to make sure that the store is well placed, but we will not be moving somebody in across the street from them just because the other agent wants to do that. Certainly when you get into higher densities, you can go ahead and modify that a little bit, but we obviously have a vested interest in seeing that the agents can be successful. And if you overload an area with liquor stores, the competition eats everybody up and nobody can make any money.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions, these gentlemen? All right. Thank you. Once again, I want to thank you, Jim. I appreciate your effort and everything you do here. Right. Once again, anything else? Okay. Great.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to the other. Is there anyone else that's compelled to testify to this issue today? I don't want to deny anybody the opportunity to speak here, but we do have the clock running. Okay, just to re-clarify what I said, or clarify what I said earlier, or repeat what I said, one of the two issues are going to become the committee bill today. If this is not the committee bill, we will request a draft be sent to the Rules Committee. And if we don't go down the road with the other one, then this will be the committee bill. And our deadline's the 30th. But I really have to say, you know, at least the non-limited and hopefully some kind of incentive, I think, to improve your stores, to improve sales, responsibly, obviously. I think they're no-brainers, too. For the life of me, why this has taken so long, and I'm not blaming you guys because you're doing the bidding of the statute and which the legislature's told you to do. I think there's definitely some things we could do here to help this. These agents right here that are doing a good job for us. So, as long as there's nothing else, I'm just going to go ahead and move on right now. And we will be deciding after the next hearing which one's going to be. But either way, there's going to be a request to draft a bill to address these issues. So I don't want anyone to be disappointed if you had to go on. I'm going to close the informational hearing on the liquor agent compensation issue. And I'm going to open an informational hearing on safety in the workplace. And I'm going to. Do we have a sign-up sheet? Or just call it? Okay, I'd like to call Gary Conklin and Drew Hagedorn from the Associated General Contractors. And I think there may be some other nice people that want to testify and speak to this issue. I know Representative Buckley will be on the phone. Are we going to call Representative
Buckley? Yes, we will call him when the time's ready, Mr. Chairman.
All right, and I just want to, before anybody starts speaking, there's some things I want to say about this issue. This is not a new issue. We had a bill last session that had a lot of support, but for whatever reason did not make it to the House floor. Every single member of this committee has been notified according to rules, regulations, and laws of how we do business here in the state of Oregon, specifically in the legislature. No one has been left out. There have been emails sent to every single committee member, and there have been phone messages left with every single committee member. I want to make that very clear, just to start out here. And if people can't be here for whatever reason, I understand that. I appreciate that. We all have lives to lead. But I want to make that very clear on the record right here. All right, gentlemen, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Conkling. I'm appearing here
along with Drew Hagedorn on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We appreciate the opportunity to chat a little bit about this issue. This is an issue that, as Mr. Chairman, you indicated, was discussed in the regular session. It's an issue which, as we're presenting it today, cast more narrowly than it was discussed in the regular session. And it's really focused on workplace safety and dealing with actually public safety. The issue that it addresses is drug-free workplaces, where many contractors and many others are required under federal law and under their own policies to implement, in large part because of the operation of dangerous equipment or the activities themselves, the occupations are hazardous. It's worth noting, I appreciate that my colleague actually ran the statistics off just to give you a little perspective of the scope of this issue. As of this October, there are nearly 15,000 Oregonians who hold medical marijuana cards. There are another nearly 8,000 pending applications. And while those numbers aren't necessarily daunting, it's kind of interesting to see the list of the requests for those, or what the cardholders have cited as their medical needs. More than 13,000 for severe pain, and more than 3,000 for persistent muscle spasms. So these are not necessarily people who are using medical marijuana for cancer. There are 400 Oregonians who have medical marijuana cards because of cancer. These are individuals who may be in the workforce, may have some chronic disease, and this is not it's not to suggest that this isn't an appropriate appropriate medication for them to use. Quite the contrary, and that's really where our bill comes in. And we've presented with you a concept that is substantially different from what was discussed in the regular session, which would have provided discretion for employers to decide whether or not to accommodate workers. This bill actually has a different pivot point. What it does is that it only allows a limit on that accommodation requirement for certain hazardous duties. And they're listed here in the concept that we've presented to you. This is not a list that we developed. It's actually a list that's already in use by Oregon OSHA. And I think by just looking at it, you can appreciate that exposure to radioactive substances, a variety of equipment, construction sites, wrecking, demolition, and shipbreaking, all I think are fairly included under a definition of hazardous duties. And what our bill would allow an employer to do is to be excused from accommodating a person who tests positive for marijuana, even if they are a medical marijuana cardholder, for one of these occupations. That does not excuse them from from accommodating them in some other part of their firm if they have those jobs available. So this is not an attempt to undermine the Medical Marijuana Act. That isn't our issue. Our issue is workplace safety in general. This bill, the bill concept that we're presenting to you, has a couple of other components. One is to give OSHA, which really isn't in the medical marijuana business, it's in the safety, workplace safety business, rulemaking authority to add additional hazardous occupations that are consistent with the measure's intent to protect workplace and public safety. So if there is something that's missing from this list and can make a good case to be added to it, then there's a path to do that. This bill also recognizes that this issue can be dealt with through collective bargaining agreements, and it allows those collective bargaining agreements to hold where this act is concerned. So we're also recognizing that sometimes
workforce and management can come to agreement about how to handle these subjects, and we think that's appropriate to recognize and allow those to stand. So that is our particular concept. We think that this bill, which by the way has been suggested by people who had reservations about, or this approach I should say, reservations about the broader act that was to, discussed in the 07 session. I'm not trying to suggest that everybody's happy with it. They probably aren't. This is one of those subjects where I don't know that you make everybody happy. But it is an approach that's much narrower and we think is more appropriately focused on the safety aspects of someone who may be impaired and using dangerous equipment or in a hazardous occupation. I'm going to now allow my colleague here to talk a little bit about why February. Why is it important to talk about this issue now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn, also for AGC. And as Gary alluded to, my role here today is to try and talk a little bit about the sense of urgency facing Oregon construction contractors. I want to direct you to the second page, backside of our written testimony, which kind of outlines a couple of issues that we're confronting. The first being the Drug Free Workplace Act of 1988. And then also the litigation that continues on and frustrates us with some of the legal ambiguities there. To start with, just give you a little bit of background on what our legal obligations are for our contractors who contract with the federal government. And for AGC members, some of our members, that's their bread and butter, is federal contract work. You can see, as the Section 1 there says, the Act requires federal contractors to agree that they will provide drug-free workplaces as a precondition of receiving a contract from a federal agency. This contradicts, at least in our view, or at least there's an ambiguity regarding whether it contradicts our obligation under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, which is to accommodate the medical use of marijuana. What would the result be if a federal agency came in and audited one of our contractors who was performing a federal contract here in Oregon? Well, there are three. And one of the attachments to that written material there is a copy of the Federal Drug-Free Workplace Act. And you'll note in subsection B that there are some significant and rather harsh sanctions that can be levied upon non-conforming contractors. One, payments for contract activities may be suspended. And when we're talking about multi-million dollar contracts, that's a very, very significant sanction. The contract may be altogether suspended or terminated. And then also, we could be debarred for up to 5 years. And again, for our contractors, that this creates a significant portion of their business, federal contract work. This is a death knell for their business. Transitioning now to what I mentioned earlier, some of the ongoing litigation, and I appreciated reading Representative Buckley's written submission. I'll be interested to hear from him a little bit later, but he references the Washburn litigation, which was a 2005 case here in Oregon that essentially stood for the proposition that an employer didn't have to accommodate someone actually using medical marijuana on the job site. But they can move them from that position to another if they tested positive, for example. That really kind of skirted the issue and left us with this continued ambiguity regarding whether or not a state agency could force or require accommodation by an employer on the job site. Now, subsequent to that, I believe January 2005 case Washburn, which was an Oregon Supreme Court case, the United States Supreme Court issued an opinion in June of that same year, and Gonzalez v. Wright. And that case stands for the proposition that under the U.S. Commerce Clause, Congress may bar the use of medical marijuana where states have even approved it for medicinal purposes. Now, the court in Washburn did not have the benefit of this Supreme Court decision. And that issue is now at bar before the Oregon Court of Appeals. I understand earlier this year the Oregon Court of Appeals heard oral arguments in the case Emerald Steel v. Boley, which you'll see referenced there in our written testimony. And that case, as we understand it, directly addresses whether or not Boley can force an employer to accommodate the medical use of marijuana. Now, we don't know what the result of that case will be. Anybody who tries to tell you what that is probably just a mere conjecture. But the concern for our contractors is that some of the restraint the federal government has shown in coming in and auditing our contracts is because it's ambiguous. We're not really sure how the Oregon law is going to be applied. We believe that this case will determine that issue decisively. On the one hand, the court may determine that, yes, Boley has the authority to do that. On the other hand, they may conclude that they do not. They conclude they do not, and the court, the case isn't appealed, then our members may not have a concern here. There may not be a conflict. But if by contrast, they conclude that indeed contractors must accommodate, we believe that there will be a direct conflict between the Oregon law and the federal law, and all of the sanctions that we alluded to earlier could be levied upon our contractors. And so that's why there's a sense of urgency here. That's why this is an issue that we are asking at least be considered for submission for drafting in 2008, because as their representatives, we just can't stand by and expose them to this kind of financial and legal liability. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, these gentlemen? Representative Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony on this. And, you know, I see that Representative Buckley has also provided testimony here. And I'm just a little confused at the moment because, from my experience, from what I know, that anybody that's impaired on a job site or at a workplace can be removed and probably fired, whether they have a medical marijuana card or not. Is that true?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey. I'm not sure that's exactly how it operates. I know that contractors routinely do that. Part of the difficulty that arises is determining when an individual is impaired or not, and as we understand it, there really isn't a test for determining that point.
Follow up,
please.
So it seems to me that perhaps at the base of this is that we need a test for impairment on this, because when you say accommodate a medical marijuana user, you're not talking about accommodating them so that they can use marijuana on a particular job site in the workplace. You're talking about they're not consuming it at the workplace. If they were doing that, they would, I would think, be able to be, you know, removed from the job site.
Mr. Chair, let me try to answer that one. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, we now conduct both pre-employment and random drug testing. The drug tests that we apply are based on urine analysis. They're looking for essentially drugs that are ones that we generally would call narcotics that are considered illegal under the federal system. Broader questions of impairment, for example, somebody using Vicodin, would not be, as I understand it, discoverable through a urine analysis test. It would require a blood test. Blood tests are more invasive. They're more expensive. And from a practical point of view, on a work site environment, not really practical. If somebody shows up for work, you give them a blood test, you won't know the result in any short period of time. So the question, there are two questions that Representative Buckley addresses. The broader question of impairment generally is something that we share, we're concerned about, regardless of its cause. The specific issue that our bill deals with, however, are for those sources of impairment that we test for. And marijuana is one of those. And the marijuana is in the testing world isn't distinguished between whether you're using it for medical purposes or any other purposes. What we're trying to do is thread the needle, frankly, to find a way that we can not do wholesale harm to Oregon's Medical Marijuana Act. That is not our goal. Our goal, in fact, is to try to help it by eliminating accommodation for activities that I think virtually anybody would argue pose dangers to that worker, to their fellow workers, and maybe to the general public if they were impaired. It is not to argue that every person that tests positive is impaired. But our situation is that is also not a variable that we get to discuss. They either test positive or they don't. If they have a medical marijuana card, under Oregon law, we're required to accommodate them. We're trying to find a way to accommodate them as long as it's not in one of these duties. That's what our bill does. No more, no less.
Well, before I go back to your follow-up, Representative Foley, I just want to say, it's the ambiguity in the law that has led to the federal decision on how to pay out to these contractors and the lawsuit. And it being a laborer who's worked under a tower crane, where the tower crane operator was brought, we all did a surprise urine analysis that day. Several people scurried off the job site. I was not one of them, I'm proud to say. The tower crane operator, who they knew he was up there, he came down, and he was not targeted, none of us were. He failed his urine analysis. Now, I don't know if he had a medical marijuana card or not. I don't want anyone who may be or even potentially impaired due to the use of medical marijuana or any other prescription drug or anything else wheeling a bunch of tons of material above my head while I'm working on a job site. We cannot take the risk, in my humble opinion, to allow that to go on. And I'm glad, I'm grateful that you've narrowed this down to these very hazardous occupations. I think that speaks to the intention to not attack the medical marijuana bill and not to deny people the use of that drug for pain or whatever medicinal purposes they use it for, and I give you credit for that. Representative Holdy, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share your sentiments. I don't want anybody impaired out there at all. I'm just worried that this could discriminate against somebody who has a legitimate use of medical marijuana when they're not impaired. And I guess that brings up a question: do we have a test positive certain for alcohol on the job site when somebody has any alcohol in their system? Are they treated the same way as this bill proposes to treat medical marijuana?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, I respect the point that you're making, and Senator Prozanski has made a very similar argument that just because you test positive doesn't necessarily mean that you are impaired. So we stipulate that's true. But to some degree, that doesn't have much to do with the problem that we have, is that they test positive. That if they have a medical marijuana card, we have to accommodate them. The question that we then have is that do you want us to accommodate them by letting them operate a crane, as the chairman said? That's all we're trying to deal with. I don't think that there is a perfect answer. And as to the broader impairment questions, we're willing to commit, and we will say so again today, that we will commit on the record to try to continue to find ways to deal with broader issues. Because safety is safety. Somebody getting hurt because somebody was under the influence of whatever is not acceptable. But we're trying to deal with something that's real and that's at hand, and that, as the chair has indicated, it's in court, and soon we're going to be in the crosshairs. That's all we can deal with right at the moment.
And on that right there, if I were an employer and I did a surprise urine analysis on my employees, I can assure you, if alcohol were in their system, they'd be sent home.
Yes.
And I'm telling you, I would also recommend, and I believe employers do, and I believe the employer I was working for at the time did give the people that were sent home an opportunity to go through treatment and come back clean and show up clean every day to work. So it isn't like they were just discarding. Believe me, a tower crane operator is a very valuable worker. They do not just grow on trees. So it's within the best interest of that contractor to make sure those valuable workers remain on the job, but remain there clean and sober for the safety, health, and welfare of everybody. Representative Holby, did you have anything to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still a little bit confused about this because I think we should treat all drugs and alcohol, you know, similarly, you know, when it comes to a workplace impairment. And I believe OSHA and our laws right now allow somebody who's impaired to be removed from the job and probably fired. I just wonder, you know, when is it okay to say that a certain level of alcohol doesn't trigger this same, you can test positive for alcohol, and no consequences to that, yet you're seeking some pretty severe consequences to somebody who legitimately may have used medical marijuana 2 weeks ago, who has never had a problem of being impaired on the job, and that seems to me to be somewhat of a conflict here with this argument, is that if you want to make a test positive for any drug or alcohol as a reason for employment, then maybe that's the policy that should be debated.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I thought I answered that, and if I didn't, I apologize for not being clear. I don't think that this authorizes people who are impaired with alcohol to work. The difference is that there is no wine drinker card holder that someone could bring out of their pocket to say, but you have to accommodate me. There isn't anything for alcohol, but there is for marijuana. And the point I'm trying to make is that we respect that. We have long-time employees who have suffered from cancer or maybe from a chronic disease. We don't want to be put into a situation of where it's just black or white, you're here or you're gone. This is our way of trying to sensitively say the one hole in the medical marijuana bill is requiring accommodation on something that's hazardous to the employee, to their fellow workers, and maybe to the general public. That's the limited scope of what this bill literally does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may, and I agree with you that, to a large degree, but I think there's a difference between testing positive and impairment, and that's, I guess, the issue that I see. Because you can test positive for alcohol and not be impaired, and many people probably do test positive for alcohol on a job site, although they're not impaired, and I think the same is true for marijuana. So, I guess that's the thing. I understand, the implications that you're speaking to, but...
Well, again, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, impairment is the concern, but the trigger is the testing positive. It doesn't matter whether you're impaired or not if you test positive. We've got the problem if you test positive. That's what I'm saying.
And if you test positive for a certain level of alcohol in your system, whether you're impaired or not driving up the road, you're going to jail. And some people react differently to alcohol. And there are those that could probably pass every single field test under the sun they would have consumed above and beyond the legal limit of alcohol in their system. And they are, under the laws, considered impaired just by the virtue of the presence of that alcohol in their system, regardless of what kind of field test they may pass. So there is, I think, that's a pretty good example of how impairment is not necessarily the litmus test. It's the presence of whatever in your system that makes a difference.
That's where our legal liability, Mr. Chair, comes from. Is what to do when somebody tests positive.
Mm-hmm. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I unfortunately don't have my bill file from Senate Bill 465, which passed the Senate rather overwhelmingly on March 14th. So I'm going to have to try and recall some of this from memory. But my concern, frankly, gentlemen, with what you're proposing here is it doesn't go far enough. And I understand why you're proposing this kind of narrowed down scope, but when the motion was made in the House on June 25th to try and pull this out of the Rules Committee, I made the comment that in Bend, our Park and Recreation District advertised a job for what I believe was a youth swim instructor and hired an individual, only to find out afterwards that this person had a medical marijuana card. and the park district was a little concerned about having somebody potentially impaired in the water teaching kids how to swim. So they had to address that and spent a lot of money and were able to get this person out of the position into something else. And I don't see something like that in your list of occupation of hazardous duties. To me, this is kind of half the loaf, which is better than no loaf at all, but I'd like to see this thing expanded. In fact, I think 465 was the ticket, and unfortunately, we didn't get it through the House. But,
well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, whether we agree or disagree, political realities are what they are. I would only mention there are two dimensions of this bill give or OSHA the ability to identify additional areas that are, again, consistent with the intent of the measure. And second of all, bargaining units can actually work these things out in a labor agreement, which might be the most appropriate way for an agency, a public agency, to address that kind of an issue, because I believe this is not, this really isn't an issue of whether it's certainly not a partisan issue, but I think that there's reasonable positions on both sides, and where we came here today was not to have a debate about the act, but rather to have a debate about I think one hole in the act, which just doesn't recognize that there are certain safety considerations that ought to be the number one priority. That's all this bill does.
And I just want to, something that was said earlier, this is not a question of whether someone is allowed or denied employment either. This is just a question of whether or not they're allowed to do these specific jobs on the job site. So this does not, and we don't even have a bill, but conceptually, we're not going out there saying, and I certainly wouldn't vote for saying, anybody with a medical marijuana card can be fired. That's not the intent of this concept as I see it. This is very much narrowing it down to specific jobs where it is not a very good idea to allow people with marijuana in their system to do. That being said, I'm an employer, and you touched on the collective bargaining part, and I appreciate that. If I'm an employer, though, and I knowingly accommodate someone to work on my job site outside of these areas, they get hurt. Their lawyer, there's some lawyer out there that'll come in and say, that contractor allowed that worker to work impaired on their job site, and I got the blood test right here to prove it. Now, and this is just, there's so much ambiguity. There's so much risk involved here. I don't know why anyone would accommodate, but that's another issue. Any other questions of these gentlemen before we move on? Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Do we have a sign-up sheet? Would you like to call Representative Buckley?
Yes, ma'am. Hold on one moment.
All right. And we're going to call Representative Buckley now. He has made it very clear he wanted to testify, and I'm grateful for that. And anyone else want to testify today? Out there? Okay. If you come on up, please. We'll listen to Representative Buckley, and then we'll go to you folks.
Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Representative. It's Teresa Van Winkle. You are now live in the Business and Labor Committee hearing. We're ready for you to testify.
Thank you so much.
Good morning,
Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Representative. How are you this fine day?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
No complaints.
Well, thank you for taking the time. I greatly appreciate the administrator getting my testimony to the members. I was able to listen online to the previous testimony on the issue, and I appreciate the point of view. As I noted in my written comments, I do want to thank Mr. Conklin and AGC for their efforts to keep the focus on the issue of safety and impairment. I think Representative Colby hit one of the central points in terms of the definition of use and the accuracy of the testing in terms of this particular substance. To respond quickly to one of Representative Burley's comments about the lifeguard situation, that some would be potentially impaired, I would suggest that we are all potentially impaired anytime that we use any substance, and we all use substances. Many of us use alcohol. Many of us use different painkilling drugs. We all have the potential to be impaired. And the major point I'd want to bring to the committee is, well, two points I want to make. One is that there's no track record of medical marijuana patients being less responsible in terms of their potential impairment than any other employee in the state of Oregon. Therefore, to legislate in a manner that assumes that they are more irresponsible or have a greater potential for impairment is simply, I believe, taking us on the wrong track. We all agree on safety. All of us agree that safety has to be the issue. The problem is that we have the testing that we have right now does not allow for an accurate interpretation of what impairment is. And the assumption of irresponsibility, I think, goes against our basic values of treating people with respect as workers in our state. The other point I would make in terms of the urgency to have this on the agenda for 2008, obviously this is a very controversial issue. We had over 4.5 hours of testimony in election rules on this. The vast majority of the testimony was from people who are participating in the program, doctors, nurses who work with people who are on the program. And these individuals over and over again testified that we're talking about people who are using a medication for chronic pain, for various illnesses. The only thing that they can use that is proven to be effective is to continue to work. So I think we have to be extremely careful when we close the door on these people. And Mr. Chair, you made the comment, and I know exactly where you come from, because I know you got a great heart, that no one wants to fire people. No one wants to see people lose their employment or their you know the sense of work they have with their job. However, this would open the door to. There's nothing in this draft proposal that says that workers would be shifted to another position, etc. This basically would open the door to saying that there is a particular medication that is legal for Oregon workers to take to handle their pain or their the challenges they have. Yet that medication, even used legally, would force them to be able to lose their job, given the circumstances of this bill. So the point I'd like to make is that we are starting to move down the track together. We're all focused on safety, a controversial issue, an issue that I'm starting to get hopefully the unions talking about, ACLU talking about. It's great the AGC is moving in this direction. I think we can get to where we need to go. I don't think we can get there in February 2008.
Thank you. Any questions of Representative Buckley?
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Cameron.
Representative Buckley, this is Representative Cameron. Good morning.
Good morning.
And just a quick question. The facts about the, you mentioned that there's no track record of hazards with medical marijuana patients. Is there a, it's an 801 form, is there a way of tracking when there's an injury on the job as to whether what medications and disclosure that people are taking? Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I'm not, President Cameron, I'm not. All I can go with from the testimony, and we repeatedly asked during the course of the Election and Rules Committee for any evidence of any injury or hazard presented, and in the 4.5 hours of testimony, there was no evidence provided.
Thank you.
Any further questions of the good representative? All right, sir. Well, thank you. I hope you had a good holiday. If I don't see you first, I hope you have a good holiday season.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Greatly appreciate your consideration.
My pleasure, believe me. Thank you.
All righty, then. Ms. Smith, would you like to go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I have not been privy to AGC's new proposal in this regard, and so I've just seen it this morning, but I want to offer a few brief comments. In the first place, I would like to say that we agree with everything that Representative Buckley has said to the committee this morning, both in his written testimony and in his oral testimony. We testified on the bill in the Rules Committee during the session, Senate Bill 465. And we feel that this is an issue. First of all, we are sympathetic and sensitive to the issue of impairment in the workplace. Our members do not want to be working side by side with someone who may put them at risk. And that's an absolute statement for us. Please keep that in mind. We do absolutely want safe workplaces. However, we believe that this bill and Senate Bill 465 before it, and this bill even as it appears to be, the concept appears to be drafted, is overly broad and strikes at one particular set of workers and doesn't really get where you want to go. We think the problem that we have, that employers have in determining impairment, is exactly that. How do they determine impairment? They don't determine impairment by a blood test or a urinalysis necessarily, although sometimes that can determine impairment. There is no simple solution to the problem, but that's where the issue needs to be focused, is how to determine impairment. Because everyone agrees that once a worker is impaired, that worker doesn't have any business in the workplace, whether the worker is impaired on antihistamines for their cold or heroin. It doesn't matter. So we would like to work with the committee and any other interested people to work on the issue of impairment and how to determine it, and not look at a quick fix, which is what we think this is, an overly broad quick fix, to take the issue off the table, but at the same time set up an issue of discrimination in the workplace against workers who have nothing other than a health issue that they're trying very hard to deal with while they continue to raise their family and support their family. So with that, I will point out two places in the concept that I think it is overly broad. And the first is in the first bullet point under number 4, where it says, accommodate medical use of marijuana in any workplace, and the last phrase is what I'm specifically talking about, regardless of where the use occurs. You know that marijuana stays in your bloodstream, stays in your hair for a very long time after impairment goes away. So that phrase, regardless of where the use occurred, will allow an employer to fire an employee for showing up positive on a test for marijuana, even though they may not have been impaired. We think that's inappropriate. Impairment's the issue. And the last is the change out of a word that we think makes a big difference. In the last bullet point on number 4, it says, a policy to achieve or maintain a drug-free workforce. That is not the employer's requirement under federal law. Federal law that they have provided to you requires a drug-free workplace. That's different than a drug-free workforce. Drug-free workplace is how you speak to impairment. And workforce is how you go beyond impairment to regulating what employees do when they're not at work. So we would suggest that you look at workplace impairment and how to determine that for any worker, regardless of substance.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan.
Yes, for the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. And I'm here to suggest that there is already a OSHA statute to check for impairment. That's provision 4, and it's in parentheses, and it says that the employer has the right to remove any employee who is impaired by drug, alcohol, medication. And so it's already in the statute. It's been since the 1940s. AWPPW's position is that they're concerned about overly zealous, random, unwarranted testing for no apparent reason, which can happen in the workplace. One question I have that I don't know is, of the 15,000 cardholders that there are in this state, how many really do have gainful employment? And I, too, echo the idea that this is discriminatory in the sense that marijuana is not your grandmother's drug of choice. And it's an ostrich in a robin's nest, if you will. But the voters voted it in 1998. And I think it would be to the chagrin of their vote if anything was to harm that in any way, although I heard the previous testimony. I'm aware of what they said. So to be clear, there is already statute for employers to remove people that are impaired. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, this is in no way, shape, or form an easy issue. And we don't have a definite way to judge if someone is impaired by marijuana because of the long time it stays in the person's system. So we're stuck, aren't we? We really are. We're stuck. We're stuck because it can be in their system and they not be impaired, or it could be in their system and we don't know where they ingested it. They could have done it on the job site 5 minutes before they took it, well, probably more than that, 2 hours before they took the test. We don't know. It's impossible to judge. So this is a very difficult issue. Any questions of these nice people?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
If I might just add one thing. We heard in testimony in the Rules Committee last session that there are tests for impairment that employers could use. They are not as simple as a urinalysis. It requires watching an employee, putting an employee through a particular, and I'm not familiar with what all the specifics of those tests are, but those tests do exist. And there are ways to determine whether or not an employee is impaired. So it's not impossible. And your analysis is probably the easiest, cheapest way to do it, and it's much too broad a brush. And I was sitting here fretting just a moment, Mr. Chair, that I forgot to mention specifically that we think that this is not an issue for the February session, given the complication and the broad, far-reaching effects that any legislation could have.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Smith. You mentioned the difference between drug-free workplace, drug-free workforce. Can you tell me how, as an employer, I prove that I'm maintaining a drug-free workplace?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, and I believe that the federal law does not have a specific way that you must prove that outlined within it. So your policy could set out how you do that, and you can have tests of employees you suspect of being impaired in the workplace that would satisfy that requirement of the federal law. We heard in the testimony that the concern is complying with federal law. There are you can, as an employer, you can develop a policy with a set of impairment testing in it that would satisfy the federal government and still maintain the rights of your workers.
Is there any follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair? Is there any policies out there that you know of now in Oregon of any of our employers that have impairment test in them versus drug test in them to implement that policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, as I said at the beginning of my testimony, I wasn't aware that this would be the particular issue on the agenda today, so I didn't do a lot of research ahead of coming here today. I can't answer your question directly. I will say, though, that we did hear testimony in the Rules Committee at the end of the last session that there are tests that employers use to determine impairment.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Alrighty then. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Would anyone else like to testify to this issue today? Alrighty then. I'm going to briefly take a moment here. I'm going to close the informational hearing on medical marijuana safety in the workplace concept.
Mr. Chair, can you want to be at ease for a moment while I get Representative Esquivel on the phone?
And I will. Oh, excuse me. I'm going to reopen the informational hearing on this issue, safety in the workplace, and we're going to call Representative Esquivel, see if he has a comment to make. He's in a class, he may not be available.
I'll speak now, okay?
Hi, Representative, it's Teresa Van Winkle. You are now live and plugged into the committee hearing.
And your class.
And your class as well. So.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Escobar. We're in the middle of an informational hearing. We've heard testimony for pros and cons on safety and work issue, and I believe you have read and been briefed on the concept that the AGC has brought forward on this. Before I open a work session, did you want to make any comments on this issue?
Well, actually, on this particular issue, this is the marijuana in the workplace issue.
Yes, sir.
What I have found, I had that in my committee, in the committee I was in last session. I think it should have gone forward. It did not, but that's unfortunate. But having said that, the same arguments are coming up, I'm sure, that came up then, which was a very lengthy discussion. We pretty much looked into that very, scrutinized it very closely, and I think I fully understand the concept. I understand what we're trying to achieve, so therefore I think we should proceed on, take a vote on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the safety and workplace issue, and I'm going to open a work session on the safety and workplace issue. And I would entertain a motion that we request a bill draft for this issue for the February session.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Cameron Musso. Is there any more discussion, comment, questions on this issue before I ask the roll be called? All right. Seeing none, please call roll.
Representative Burley?
Yes.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Excused.
Vice Chair Escobar?
Yes.
Vice Chair Helby?
No.
All right. Aye. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on that. Representative, before we let you go, do you have any more comments?
No, I just wish I were there, but I have to be educated here, so that's why I'm here.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Have a good
holiday. I have to get my license back. I get it renewed, so that's why I'm here for my educational requirement.
Thank you. If I don't see you, have a good holiday.
Does that make him an independent contractor?
Oh, we're not doing that one, are we?
Not today. Not here.
See you later. Thanks, gang, and if you need me, give me a call.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, Teresa, if you'll help me here, then requesting that a bill draft be made and sent to the Rules Committee. Do we need a motion on that as far as liquor agents?
No, Mr. Chair. What will happen is that a letter will be drafted. You'll submit a letter to Chair Rosenbaum and to the and copied, and it will also be forwarded to the Speaker's office and the Rules Committee Administrator. There also needs to be a level of buy-off from both vice chairs as well, preferably signature on the letter. But in the case of Representative Escobar, I may be able to get a signature. If not, he can either email or call the Speaker's office and get that taken care of.
I regret not asking about that.
But I can take care of that this afternoon.
Very good. Representative Holby, are you in support of requesting a bill draft on liquor agent compensation be sent to the Rules Committee? I am.
Mr. Chair, I would have preferred to do it as our committee bill, but yes, I will support that going to Rules.
I can appreciate that sentiment, Representative, believe me. Okay, any other? Do you all have a... do I hear consensual support for the liquor agent concept?
Yes.
Compensation?
Good.
That makes it a lot easier. Let me see. I also want to... What time is it? Any kind of time?
1:30.
We're having a work session, a work group on independent contractor and compliance to that law at 1:30 in what room?
167A, which is the conference room for the Commission on Indian Services.
Yeah, just for anyone that's in the room that's interested in that or listening that wants to come down. Anything else for the good of the order? Representative Burley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've got a handout, Teresa, if you'd share it with folks. And I apologize for not getting this to you sooner, Mr. Chair, and obviously we can't do anything as far as working on this at this point in time. But I wanted to bring to the committee's attention that an issue came up here last month when on October 31 the Oregon Court of Appeals ruled in a case, MBSEF versus the Employment Department, and MBSEF is the Mount Bachelor Ski Education Foundation, which is a nonprofit group in Bend that trains young kids in racing and snowboard competition and whatnot. And the problem was that one of the people that volunteered for MBSEF The volunteers get a ski pass, an annual ski pass for Mount Bachelor, because the volunteers have to be up on the slopes setting up race courses and setting up all the features for the training and the competitions. This particular individual ended up filing at some point here a unemployment claim and listed the MBSEF volunteer stuff down as employment and put the $910 down as the value of the pass to try and get some unemployment benefits. So the employment department saw that and triggered an audit, which led to these to the court case, because MBSEF was arguing that no, this person's not an employee, this person's a volunteer. And anyways, on October 31, the appeals court ruled against MBSEF, and you know, there were several issues involved in that that dealt with, you know, what is an employee-employer relationship, how is that defined in statute, what constitutes wages and remuneration. And the concerns that we have is that this really isn't, the question's not really limited to just the employment department and whether or not MBSEF should be paying unemployment insurance for volunteers, but it also extends as far as should we be withholding taxes on the value of the pass? Should we be paying workers' comp?
They are.
You know, if this is a, if this is an employee-employer relationship, then are we going to be dealing with minimum wages? These are volunteers. And I can tell you that, you know, for 12 years, I was a volunteer ski patroller at Mount Bachelor, and we got actually family passes if you were on the Alpine Patrol. And I look back on that, and I go, my goodness, you know, that's quite a chunk of change. And Mount Bachelor, you know, there's 60-some volunteer patrollers that cover that mountain. So I'm going to be looking at some legislation on this, and unfortunately, as I said, it was too late to actually get it introduced here. Oh, I see this. I think
Representative?
Yes.
I asked our able-bodied committee administrator to call to see if there's a limit to the number of requests we could make. So, and I think, you know, the urgency question, you know, the fiscal year for every employer in the state, clocks continue to tick, so maybe it should be sorted out in February, but I just wanted to let you know that. I don't know if there's a limit to the number of drafts we can make that would be referred to the Rules Committee. So if that's the case and you want to make that motion.
Well, I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chair. I would like to see this if moved to the Rules Committee, if that's feasible. I've also checked to see if any other House committees were meeting this week. Energy and Environment is the only one that's scheduled on Friday, and I think the chair already has a legislative concept in mind, so I don't think we'd be able to get this before that committee. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, I just got the phone to the Speaker's office. They would prefer only for one bill to be, an additional bill to be forward to rules. However, if there is bipartisan support, then that's not an absolute barrier. So,
well, I have listened to the representative this morning before the hearing today, and I think it merits attention. People are going to have to file their tax returns. People have to comply with workers' compensation and unemployment.
And well, I had a meeting with the Deschutes County Child Abuse Task Force, which is made up of many nonprofit groups all focusing on that issue. And they all asked me, you know, what does this mean for them? Because they use volunteers extensively. I had a meeting with the board of directors for the community college over there, and they have a foundation that extensively uses volunteers that get free meals at their annual banquet. And every one of them to the organization has said, what does this mean for our organization and our volunteers? Now, I've met with the employment department. They've been very helpful in providing us information. And you know, the law is the law. I mean, they're interpreting the law. The appeals court said your interpretation is correct. So what I'm asking is, can we fix the law so that it's more clear on when is a volunteer and not an employee? Because I don't have to tell you that, you know, if the Rose Festival gives out $15 T-shirts, does that make all those volunteers employees?
Sure. Department is shaking their head. They don't know either.
Representative Burley, I know from sitting on a previous industry workers' comp review board that your hours up on the ski slopes as a volunteer ski patrol, you were being covered under workers' comp. I know at Mount Hood, for example, they pay workers' comp insurance on their ski patrol.
on their volunteers. And actually, there has been claims by those volunteers for accidents they've had why they were actually on that job. So it is an issue that's out there. And be interesting. Yeah, when you blew your knee out, you probably should have gone through the workers' comp.
Should have filed a claim.
So it's an issue that there's a lot to it, more than just the unemployment, that we can certainly look at.
Well, what do the rest of the committee think about this issue, this concept? You have anything more to say?
It sounds like it's probably more complicated than the memo leads us to believe, but the memo sounds like a no-brainer as far as it's something that should be looked at, mm-hmm. and I'd be supportive of looking at it in February.
I agree with Representative Edwards that there's probably a lot more to this. I mean, when you're a volunteer, if you get paid, in something of value, that almost sounds like an employee. So, but I can certainly see there's some maybe there isn't a clear enough line there. I don't mind looking at it. I don't know if we are going to be able to solve this in the February session, but certainly doesn't mean we can't try.
Well, let's run it up the flagpole and see what happens, and we'll just do our best. Okay. So I believe we should request it as another draft be sent to the Good Rules Committee, which the chair may not be too happy with this committee, but we'll see. She is a very objective and impartial human being, and she has my full support in her race next year. I just want to, in that context, we will request that. So that's three requests we're making today.
Work session to do that?
No, since this is an additional bill, we don't need to do that.
So is there anything else for the good of the order before I gavel us out of here? All right, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.